This is Empower the Spirit with Dr. Douglas Kelly.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Empower the Spirit for Sunday, November 20th, 2011. I'm Doug Kelly, and I'm, of course, here with Dr. Vicki Hunter. Hi, Vicki.
Good evening, everyone. Good to be here tonight. Good show. I'm excited about tonight's show for sure.
Definitely. It's going to be a good show tonight, an informative one, and hopefully we'll get a lot of people to listen to it if they're not already familiar with the topic. But let me go through some of the stuff here. Empower the Spirit is a weekly broadcast in the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science as part of our regular educational program. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, and that's what we'll be doing tonight. I'd like to welcome our live listeners as well as those listening to the archive. Now, tonight we're going to be talking about essentially healthy boundaries, and, well, and there's so many words to describe it. You know, who owns you when evil acts are committed by good people? This is a fascinating topic. We're going to be talking about the Milgram experiments, which was a fascinating experiment. Now, there's sure to be some questions, so if you have questions, feel free to ask them in the chat room, or you can call in. The numbers are on your screen, 714-459-3973. Reverend John Hightower will be screening your calls as usual tonight, so if you've got some comments, we'd love to hear them, because this is a fascinating topic. So, tonight we're going to be, Dr. Vicki and I are going to be kind of combining the shows and just kind of going through this topic and exploring different aspects of it.
Well, this is my favorite kind of topic, I tell you.
Yeah, because it's got such potential meaning, you know. And so let's get into it. Now, some of you may be familiar with Dr. Stanley Milgram. I believe he was a doctor. I know he was a professor at Yale, so I'm pretty sure he was a doctor. Anyway, back in 1961, Milgram devised an experiment. His question was, why, you know, during the Holocaust, why were there so many people who participated in these death camps? I mean, that's a question that's been on my mind. I remember back in 1993, wow, it's almost been 20 years ago, I went to Germany with my folks and extended family a little bit. It was in November of 1993, and I had an opportunity to tour Dachau concentration camp. You know, and that's tough. I mean, it's hard to go through that and see what was done to people. It really was. But they had pictures and different things and different pieces in their museum there. One of the things that we watched was a video of the time, and it was this particular segment of the video was when the Americans, and I believe the Russians were probably in there as well, but the Americans were, the end of the war was there, the Americans were invading and coming in into these concentration camps and releasing everybody. And after that, what they did was they took the townspeople and showed them what was going on in these concentration camps. And this really struck me. It really stayed with me because these German townspeople were appalled and crying at authority then made the townspeople clean it up, bury dead bodies. And this video showed that. And that really amazed me. I'm thinking to myself, how could these people allow this to go on? It's right in their back door. And I just couldn't understand that. And here they were, and they were truly shocked at the horror, the things that had gone on there. I never could explain that. I could never understand why that happened until I was exposed to Dr. Stanley Milgram in his experiment. Now, here a couple of weeks ago, It was on an episode of Curiosity, which if I remember correctly, it's a, I think it's on the History Channel or the Science Channel, one of those channels. And it was on the topic of, you know, how evil are you or that sort of thing. And I had for the first time seen the Milgram experiment, and I'll explain how it went. It was fascinating, and it answered so many questions for me, and I could just see all kinds of topics to discuss, and that's why we're talking about it tonight. So let's talk about the Milgram experiment. Now, Stanley Milgram passed away in 1984. He wrote a book in 1974. His focus in this experiment was on authority figures. Why do people obey authority figures and seemingly go against their own moral imperatives? So that was what he was trying to figure out. Now, there's a number of aspects to this experiment, and if you want to learn more about it, then I would recommend that you do this. There is some good information on Wikipedia. Do a search for the Milgram experiment, and Milgram is M-I-L-G-R-A-M, Milgram experiment. If you go to YouTube, there's a number of videos on that as well, and you'll get a real feel for what that experiment was all about. So here's the way it went. And he did a number of variations of this. But essentially, in 1961, they advertised for participants for this study, and it was under the auspices that they had found this new way of helping people to learn better, and it involved these minor shocks to them. And so they advertised for people, participants, to help with this study. And the ad says that they would pay them $4 for an hour of their time. Now, $4 back in 1961 was equal to somewhere in the neighborhood of $30. So, you know, hey, cool, $30 an hour, that's not bad. So they brought these folks in, and they had this the machine, and they had several actors as part of this experiment. The only non-actor in the experiment was the participant. So they had some roles. One of them was the role of the experimenter, and probably, you know, some sort of a professor-looking type guy. It was not Milgram. He was overseeing the experiment, but the experimenter, the guy that's allegedly leading this experiment, was the an actor. Then they had two roles in this experiment. One would be the teacher, and that was always the participant, never an actor. Then they had a role of the learner, and the learner was always an actor. And here's the way it went. The participant would come in, the alleged other participant who was going to be the learner, who was actually an actor, would come in, and they would explain what they were going to do, and they would give them a piece of paper which gave them their role. The participant, who was not an actor, was always the teacher. Okay, so they you know, were going through these motions. Here's the way it worked. They explained to this teacher, the participant, that they found a way to help people learn better by applying mild electric shocks when they got an incorrect answer. So the learner, who was an actor, go into another room. The teacher would sit in front of this box with a bunch of knobs on it. Now, if you're on the show page tonight, I put a picture of Stanley Milgram along with what they call the shock box. And you can see it there. There's a bunch of switches on it. And the shocks would be applied starting out very mild, like 15 volts, and then they would increment in 15 volts for every incorrect answer. The teacher, the participant, unknowing participant, would read some word pairs. The learner, who was an actor in another room, would then give an answer by clicking on 1, 2, 3, or 4 for the answer. It was multiple choice. They usually got the first couple of questions correct, but then after that, when they would get an incorrect answer, the teacher, the participant, would have to push the button, starting with the very mild shock of, say, 15 volts, would have to push that button and give them this mild electric shock. Now, a couple caveats here. Number one, the learner, the actor, was never shocked. There was never any shock supplied. But the teacher, the participant, did not know that. Secondly, the learner, who was an actor, would say something about a heart condition. This is one of the variations of the experiment, would complain, okay, you know, I'll do this, but I have this heart condition, so just want you to be aware of that. So now the participant who's playing the role of the teacher is aware that there's a potential heart condition here with this fellow participant who's really an actor. Okay, so the teacher, the participant, goes through the questions, and every time the learner got an incorrect answer, which was most of the time, they would have to apply successively higher electric shocks. And every time they did, there would be a recording, because there was this intercom between the two participants, one being the actor, an intercom, and they had pre-recorded responses, so it wasn't even live responses. And so every time they get a little bit higher, you'd hear the actor, the learner, say, "Oh, ouch," you know, that sort of thing. And they would get successively more intense. And so this would go on. And the big question was, how far would these participants go in administering these electric shocks? But remember, nothing was being administered, but the participant didn't know that. So how far would the participants go? Well, in most of the cases, they would get up to a specific, what they call kind of a threshold voltage. It was 135 volts. Now, I don't know if you've ever been shocked, you know, with your house current. In the United States, it's 110 volts. I mean, that it stings a bit, you know. So you're thinking about 135 volts, you know, it can really sting. And when they finally got to this threshold level of 135 or so volts, then the recording from the learner allegedly says, "Oh my God, my heart's bothering me now. I can't take this anymore. I don't want to do it anymore." And in most cases, the participant, who had no idea of the reality of this, would turn around and look at the experimenter, remember the professor type, and say, you know, he doesn't want to go on. Now, this is what's interesting. There were four pre-chosen responses that the experimenter would tell the participant. The first time they said, "Hey, he doesn't want to go on," the experimenter would say, "Please continue." If they continued to object, the experimenter would say, the experiment requires that you continue." Now, if the participant continued to object again, the third phrase would be said by the experimenter is, "It is absolutely essential that you continue." And if they again objected, the fourth response was, "You have no other choice. You must go on." Now, if they objected after this, then the experiment was halted. Now, here's the interesting kicker on this whole experiment. The participant was told up front that they could stop at any time they wanted to. They could quit at any time. They could walk out and quit and still keep the money. Interesting. Now, what were the results? And by the way, the shocks, they started out at 15 volts and went all the way up to 450 on this shock box. So there were switches for all the way up to 450 volts. The interesting thing was that somewhere in the vicinity of about 65% of the participants went all the way. When they got to that 135-volt threshold point, and that's when the learner, the pre-recorded messages say, "Ouch, I can't take this anymore, my heart's hurting," that sort of thing. After that, every time they administered a voltage, they would hear nothing from the participant, or from the learner, rather. So the participant didn't know whether the learner had a heart attack, didn't know what was going on, didn't know if they were hurt, didn't know anything. Now, almost all of the people in this experiment, all of the participants I'm talking about now, they showed some stress. They were nervous. They didn't know what to do, and they would object, and the experimenter would say, "Please continue." And they would continue. And so here are your everyday average citizens off the street participating in this, going way, way beyond in committing. "I can't do this anymore." And the only reason that they continued was because the experimenter said, "Please continue. You must continue. You have no choice. You have to continue." And so they would continue. Most of them would. 65% of them would continue all the way up to the max. You know, and that's an interesting thing. Now, why? Now, after the experiment, the people who were conducting the experiment in Milgram, and probably in this case, but it's been conducted many times. But the psychologists in charge of it would come out and explain, first of all, that no electric shocks were administered at all. Of course, the people were very relieved. But the experiment overseer, if you will, would ask them if this were real and that person on the other in the other room died as a result of these shocks, who would be responsible? And a lot of people pointed to the experimenter, who was the actor, who kept telling them to continue. And so out of this study, and this was done many times, and the results were fairly consistent, out of the study, it really shows a number of things, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, but it shows peer pressure, it shows femesteem, it shows that even ordinary, everyday people who would never hurt anyone, it shows how they can get drawn in to actually doing harm simply because an authority figure tells them or insists on them doing it. Fascinating study. Now, there's some variations on this experiment, too. One of the variations, which I found very interesting and completely in line with the whole psychology of it all, was that they would bring in a participant as the teacher. They would still have the actor as the learner, but they would bring in an additional actor as a second teacher. So you have the participant sitting right next to another teacher who was in fact an actor, but the participant didn't know that. And so they would go through the experiment, and when the teacher who was the actor would object and say, no, I'm not doing this anymore at all, and would walk out, in most cases, the participant would also bow out of it. In other words, the participants who went all the way to the end were very, very few, if any. There were only a couple. So you can see that peer pressure, if you will. You can see that if somebody else takes the lead, people will follow. There was also a variation that they did on the same thing where the teacher who was the actor sitting next to the participant would continue all the way to the end, even if the participant objected, and the participant still went along with it. Interesting stuff. Any thoughts, Vicki, so far?
Well, I got a lot of thoughts.
Go ahead.
I got a lot of thoughts on this. You know, it really speaks to how people will surrender their belief system to an authority. And we see this layered throughout society. You know, people, this is as simple as this, Doug. People go for groceries and they think because it's in the store, passed by the FDA or the government has approved it, there's the assumption that it's approved, people think it's healthy to eat without reading ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this assumption to a power that's so subliminal now. And what, you know, what this Milgram experiment was obvious. I mean, it's an obvious inflicting of pain, no matter if it's just voltage. But there's an obvious inflicting of pain that because people were told to do it, they did it. Now, it only takes one to say, I'm not doing it, and then the people are relieved to say, oh, well, I don't have to do it.
Right, we're not alone, you know. I'm not alone in my defiance.
And I wonder, my question is, at what point and how much do people disassociate from their inner voice, even the intuition, because that's my specialty, is at what point do we disassociate from our instincts and our intuitions to know better? And at what point are we willing to risk ourselves to stand up for what we know to be correct action?
Yep.
This is the ultimate question, and which is precisely why I love this subject so much.
Absolutely.
Nobody likes to be persecuted. Nobody likes the finger pointed at them.
And we all want to fit in. You know, we don't want to, you know, they're being paid for this, and by contract, they could have walked out at any point and still kept their money, but they continued with it. And so this is a huge, huge deal. Now, here's a question to our listeners. Picture yourself in that situation. What would you have done? You're there all alone. You're the teacher, the participant. You have no idea that these shots are not real. You don't know that there's actors here. You think it's all a real thing. What would you do? How far would you go? Now, I've asked myself that very same question. And when I was watching this documentary, I'm asking Doug, how far would you go? Now, I have a knowledge of electronics. I have a degree in electronics. I'm familiar with voltages and shocks and this sort of thing. So going into it, I'm not alarmed. You know, you get two people going into it. I would have been willing to take a few of the mild shocks. But going up to, you know, to the voltages they're talking about, I would have instantly known, oh, no, this is way too high. I mean, there's no amperage there, so it's not going to kill them, but it's going to shock the hell out of them. And, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go. So the final for me was when the other person said, I don't want to do this anymore. That's it. You know, if they object, that's it. We're done here. I don't care what you say. We are done. I'm done anyway.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know anything about electronics, but I am familiar with pain. I, you know, having come from a violent childhood, the minute I see anybody in pain or even the notion of inflicting pain, I'm done. You know?
Oh, sure.
And so we each have, but this speaks to how we each have our own, kind of our own brain files or our own reference points of how we make decisions and to what degree we pursue things to make decisions, because we each have our own referencing.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I look for that thread that we're all in, that commonality. When you do see a pain or you're hearing somebody in pain, that would be that, mm-hmm. as we've talked about, Doug, the do no harm, do right.
Now, you go ahead and then I'll...
No, that's pretty much where in our conscience is to, you know, ask ourselves. And, you know, we have a morality reference point also.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, to me, spiritual.
Now, if this were real, I mean, if the experiment had really been administering electric shocks, I can tell you right now that nobody's going to go up to 135 volts and like it at all. So you're going to get a lot of, oh, wow, that's too much. This is way too strong, guys. I'm not doing this anymore. You get that so much sooner in reality if people were really being shocked. Because, you know, it gets, I mean, when you get up to 60, 70, 80, 90 volts, I mean, come on. I mean, 100 volts, yeah, you know, you're going to get real, it's going to kiss
yep.
you good.
We have to think about the time that this experiment was done, 1961. Not a lot of people were familiar still with electricity, electronics, or how any of it worked. There were not many specialists except the scientists in that field. You know, you had people going into being electricians or, you know, other specialties, but the day is 1961.
Yeah.
Not, you know, I didn't even have a television in my house at that year. So yeah. That's how I can reference by age the sociology of the time.
Now, Kathy mentions that she wouldn't have volunteered to participate in the experiment in the first place, knowing pain would be inflicted. Now, there were a small handful of people, once they learned what the experiment was about, actually objected and would not participate. And it's also important here to know that mild electric shocks are not painful. Mild electric shocks. Put a 9-volt battery to your tongue, and that's what I'm talking about. It doesn't hurt. You know, it just, you know, may not like it, but it doesn't really hurt. It's not painful. So there's a limit, and it's a rather small limit on electric shocks to how far you can go before it becomes painful. I mean, it's a small limit. So there is a margin there. It's really not painful. It's just part of the psychology. But you go past that, now we're inflicting pain. And so the question is, who owns you? Think about these participants. Who owned them? They went into that experiment thinking probably that they owned themselves. But in reality, at the end, who owned them? It was the experimenter, who was actually an actor, but it was the experimenter who owned them. This is why, explains why ordinary people can inadvertently get involved into what are called evil acts. Now, one of the things I want to do is just give you the dictionary definition of evil. It just means morally wrong or bad, immoral, harmful, injurious, that sort of thing. We all pretty much know that. So how far would you go? You know, who owned them and who owns you? Now, there's been a recent example of the very same thing that has been in the news over the last couple of years. Vicki, you wanted to talk about that.
Well, you know, this is a really important one that speaks to even the metaphysical community, because in the name of self-help and in the name of people being on their vision quests, James Arthur Ray, who is better known as one of the participants in the book and movie called The Secret, had a sweat lodge in which several people died. Now, there's a lot of debate about what actually happened. It could have been toxins off the rocks because he didn't know which ones to use. The wood that was used for burning was, treated and toxic. There's a whole number of reasons. But here was the interesting thing for me. While it was on trial, and I watched some of the trial and the footage, was the people who were interviewed who were at the sweat lodge, in the sweat lodge, and people were complaining that they physically couldn't endure anymore. These people, a few of them spoke up, and one in particular was a nurse. And she spoke up to say, excuse me, this fellow's having a really hard time. Now, it was played down, kind of poo-pooed, and never mind, you're going to endure a lot of, you know, difficulty. This is part of the process. So people sat back and let these people suffer, and three people died, I believe. Now, he's since been convicted of manslaughter. Which is, to me, I don't believe anybody enters that kind of an arena with an intent to bring harm. I don't think he had any thought of killing anybody. But I think there's a negligence at so many levels. And also, what is really important is the prefacing, much like the Milgram experiment. There's a prefacing. Yes, you can leave, but you will endure pain. You can handle this. You're going to go through, you know, some kind of a conscious illumination. You're going to have this. And so there was the preparedness for a measure of pain, but how much pain, nobody knew. But also, not one individual, and these are professionals. We're talking doctors, lawyers, nurses, professional, intelligent, smart people. No one rescued the people who were suffering. Fascinating, because people gave their power to the authority, in this case James Arthur Ray, and that was that. So this is a very recent, just very one small example, although profound. It's a small example of how easily people surrender power in the name of achieving something outside themselves. Because they don't know what they have to go through. They're trusting somebody else that this is for good, that the outcome will be for good. You know, everyone will benefit, and they really do not believe that there'll be, you know, that much suffering, permanent damage, or death.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating, fascinating.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's a part of psychology, and this is something that most people generally are not confronted with in these kinds of situations. I mean, it's not an everyday thing when you're in a sweat lodge and people are hurting, or when you know participating in some experiment like this. And it's a great thing to raise awareness. How would you respond to such a thing? How would you react when the authority? I mean, think about who could be the authorities. It could be the government. It could be the police. It could be anybody. You know, it could be a teacher. It could be somebody you really respect and trust.
Well, you know, Kathy just made a comment in the chat, Doug, about how no one can control your spirit, but they can control your mind. And I would like to speak to that very thing for a moment. Our minds, when we're young and impressionable and we don't know who we are, we're not encouraged to know who we are. We don't know the rules of our environment. And we're trusting people in positions of authority to tell us the rules of the environment. But I really believe that deep inside, there's a conscience that speaks to all of us. And sometimes we have to, you know, we're going to make a few bad choices, perhaps. We're going to make some errors along the way
sure.
to say, oh, really, that didn't feel good. Oh, you know what, in hindsight, that wasn't a good thing. But I think that's the evolution of consciousness. That's the evolution of each of us becoming more illuminated to ourselves and what I call universal laws and principles at every level. So the mind can only be controlled if it's still impressionable. When you know who you are,
and
nobody, and I mean this sincerely,
and why you
nobody,
are,
and why you are who you are, no one can tell you what to do. You will never walk over the edge. I truly believe that.
I agree. Now, there is one instance in which the mind could be controlled, and that's through drugs. I get that. But aside from drugs, just everyday life, you know, if you know who you are and why you are who you are, you're not going to let it happen. And that's why it's so crucial to know who you are and, more importantly, why you are who you are, your core values. What are your core values? Are they there through osmosis? You know, in other words, you got them growing up. You know, that's a danger area. We as adults cannot, not fall back on that cop-out. Well, that's just the way I was raised. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter anymore. You're an adult. You have a responsibility and an obligation to choose your core values, who you are and why you are who you are. And that's what life is about. It's about continually raising our awareness. We grow and evolve. That's what evolution is raising your awareness to be aware of things like this. And this is such a fascinating thing, it's a favor that, I mean, I feel honored that I even found out about this, because it does explain so much, and it preps us for situations like that, because these authority figures can be anybody. They can be the abusive boyfriend that the gal won't press charges against, or vice versa. It can be the religion, the religious leaders. That was my problem. They didn't really ask me to do evil acts per se, but, you know, that was what bound me. What about my parents?
We're asked to bend our thinking, and this is critical. You know, very recently, in the last couple of weeks since we've discussed this topic and preparing for the show, Doug, I know a teacher of young, you know, early grade school kids. I asked her this question. If your principal came to you and said, I am, you know, going to put corporal punishment back into play, and your 30 kids will be subject to the strap, let's say, if they're bad, would you go along with that? She said, hell no. I said, well, what if the teacher now said, I'm going to give electric shock to these 30, say the principal, I'm going to give electric shock to these kids if you don't comply. And she paused and she said, well, geez, I guess I have to think about that. Now, that spoke to me about the threat of danger versus, you know, one kind of threat of danger versus another, because it's where you have to, you know, harm these kids versus I will harm these kids if you do not, which was a really interesting thing. I said, but the abuser is the abuser is the abuser. And in any other form, they're going to do what they want to anyway. If they are inclined to behave that way, such as the husband who tells the wife, if you don't do this, I'm going to beat the children. So she complies. You see, because she thinks in her mind that she's going to protect the children, when in fact she's just given more ammunition for the abuser to continue. Because anybody who's capable of that, you know, the threat is just part of it. They're going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how we manipulate or how we can be manipulated. And no one has more compassion, truly, and I say this from my heart, no one has more compassion than I do for people who are victimized in domestic situations, who feel trapped. And I think we all have our own story We all have our own story to tell, you know, fear of looking out for our kids, fear of, you know, danger here. And when you've only, let's say you've got three choices and none of them are good in your mind, and because you don't, your mind won't think outside those three choices, or the choices that you have outside those three are just too overwhelming to look at, such as a simple thing like leave. You know, your reality is limited. And until we go through a process of expanding that, you know, reality for thinking, it's a very tough process. So I have absolute compassion for it. But if we can see it more clearly in that people who are capable of thinking of this and who continue to inflict pain on others, they're going to do it anyway, whether they're, you know, and if there's enough of us standing together saying, sorry, you can't do that, they do have to, you know, change their behavior, in my view.
And it becomes easier, of course, as the study, the experiment showed, when there's more than one.
When there's more than one.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's just as simple as coming up with a good idea. You know, I've told you this story before, Doug, when my kids were younger, raising children, and I got really tired of buying birthday cards for all their little friends and birthday parties. And I said to my oldest daughter, I said, why don't you make a card? You know, we'll get the sparkles out and the glue and we'll do stuff. And she, oh, Mom, nobody does that. And I said, well, maybe they should. Well, you know, she braved it, bless her heart. And she made this beautiful card for her girlfriend. Do you know, by the end of the school year, everybody was competing to see who could outdo the other for making birthday cards. You know, and since then, I don't know if I was tapping into a collective unconscious, but since then we have every measure of scrapbooking that people are all just dying to make their own stuff. And I watched this, though, as these young kids started to get involved, started to get creative, and I was very excited. But what I could tell my daughter is, see what you started? Isn't that great? And you did that. Oh, Mom, but it was you. No, it wasn't. I only had the idea. You did it. And that's empowering. Do you know she's carried a lesson as simple as that? She's carried it through her whole life.
That's good.
So this is where we can, to young people, in that empowerment to self, the empowerment of one's own thinking, one's own will, determination, provided you're checking in with yourself to, again, as we go through all the principles of the church, the principles of the school, that we're not infringing on others. And I think this is where people have a bit of a hard time, is that, you know, the law of non-interference, and where, you know, they're worried about disrespecting or stepping over the boundaries, which is a huge part of this subject.
Yes, absolutely. And if you look at some everyday examples, we've talked about some, but the more I think about this, the more I see it. What about, you're in school, you know, and teachers, somebody wants you to do something that conflicts with your own principles. Maybe that doesn't happen very often, but if it did, what would you do? What about your religious beliefs? So, you know, and probably most people listening to this wouldn't have this issue, but how do you think religious leaders have gotten people to act evilly over the centuries? Think about the Crusades. Think about the Inquisition. Think about the Salem witch trials. Think about all those times. Think about current times, modern times over in the Middle East. You know, wow. You know, think about just families who are devoutly religious. And if you don't quite agree with those beliefs, as you know, you have to go against your entire family, and they may disown you, and a lot of times they do. And so you have to ask, you know, who are you? Why are you who you are? Who are you, and why are you the way you are? But let's talk about, as mentioned in the information for this segment, let's talk about how we can avoid inadvertently succumbing to that authority pressure, that peer pressure, and ending up doing something that we never thought we would have or never intended to do. The secret, as I've mentioned many times before, the secret of all this is to take your power back. Now, a lot of folks may think, well, that's pretty simplistic, isn't it? And on the surface, perhaps it sounds like it. But I'm here to tell you, and I can't emphasize this enough, the key to most of our troubles is simply taking your power back. What does that mean? It means several things. And
it usually means you're not popular.
Yeah, it often does.
That's a big one.
But who do you want to be more popular with, yourself or with others? You know, that's the big question.
Absolutely.
This all ties into them esteem. And for those who may not have heard that expression before, we have self-esteem and we have them esteem. You either esteem yourself or you esteem others more than you. People with self-esteem validate themselves. They don't need external validation to feel good about Okay, I believe we are back on the air. You may need to refresh your page to hear us. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Type that in a,
John says we're back, and it's showing up in the chat. So, you know, in addition to the them esteem is that secondary gains. That you know, we've talked about before, that I don't want to give up this to get that, you know, but I want to keep that and I don't want to surrender this. And it's a matter of the secondary gains. I just love that phrase, you know, because it's so appropriate that
it is,
you know, we're benefiting somehow, even if it's to gain approval.
Exactly. And that's what them esteem is all about. It's the secondary gain of having people like us. And that's one of those traits of human nature. We all like to have people like us, think we're cool, think, you know, accept us. That's part of human nature. But at what cost? And that's the big question here. So,
I was going to say, in schools right now, and I've heard this, you know, psychological term recently many times, which is called like a social defiance disorder, if you dare speak up on your own behalf to disagree with the authority, the present authority. Like if you're disagreeing with your doctor, if you're disagreeing with your teacher, you know, if you're disagreeing with your parent, when the parent may well be wrong, that, you know, kids are now being diagnosed, people are being diagnosed with this thing called social defiance disorder, which I think it just goes against the grain of everything I believe and what I think the school believes and the church believes is the right to speak up on your own behalf and then to negotiate to a middle ground. Now, I'm not talking about a defiance disorder that's angry and violent. I'm just talking about people who are contrary to the present-day current thinking.
Right.
And who might be a little bit clued into governments, economies, teachers, and authority. And I remember when my oldest, back in junior high school, many years ago now, had been on a peer support council. And I had said to her, you know, for as much as you kids are going to try to self-govern and make decisions with the faculty of the school, remember that you're still kids. These are adults, and they have ultimate power. Well, a number of days after these first few meetings, I get a call from the principal who said, you know, I heard something from your daughter that I find very discerning. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I'm trying to encourage them that they can make these decisions. And she says to me, well, kids don't really have power. You have the power ultimately. And he said, I find that very disconcerting. And I said, but she's right. I told her that. So let's not fool each other. Let's not mislead kids. Let's not, you know, lie to them. They're doing their best to participate as much as you allow them to, because you have an authority, even if it's subliminal, and even if it's in your way that you're manipulating kids to act in the way you want them to. And he didn't like that. Now, I am defying him. My child is defying him in a way. But it's something as simple as that small act that put up their red flags about, well, I'm just speaking a truth. In my view, I mean, I'm just saying, look, this is the way it is. You guys have ultimate power. And he didn't like to hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, they're kids. They have parameters. I mean, we all have parameters. It's just that kids have more. So
exactly.
Let's explore, as I started to before we got dropped out here by Blog Talk, let's talk about how you can avoid this. We talked about self-esteem and them esteem, and that's really what it boils down to, is them esteem. So this is where the life leadership paragon comes into play. And if you recall, there are basically four skills: self-acceptance, self-responsibility, respect for free will, and they all result in self-completeness. A person who is complete within themselves knows who they are, why they are who they are, and are not easily dissuade. You know, they do not easily succumb to these types of events where they're doing something that's contrary to their own moral compass, their own moral imperatives. The first of these is self-acceptance. You have to accept yourself for who you are. Just accept that. Yes, we can all work to be better, and that's part of it, but you still have to accept yourself just the way you are right here and right now, and then work to make whatever improvements you want to. But self-acceptance does not mean self-deprecation, self-denigration. You have to accept yourself and understand that mistakes are a part of life and that you are perfect just the way you are. We're a perfect work in progress. Tomorrow I'll be better than I am today. It's an evolution. So if you don't have self-acceptance, you're not going to have self-esteem. You're going to be troubled and plagued by them-esteem because you're always seeking to do what somebody else wants so you can get their approval. If you accept yourself, you won't do that. Go ahead.
If I can inject, once you know about something, you now have the responsibility of that knowledge.
Absolutely.
And that's very key to self-acceptance. Once you learn something about yourself or life, you now have to step into the responsibility of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's the next one, self-responsibility. You have to accept responsibility for who you are and where you are. You know, the fact of the matter is that we are all where we are because of us, because of what the decisions and choices we've made in life. That's just the reality of it. And we can think, well, I didn't want those bad things to happen, that bad relationship or whatever. Well, of course you didn't. But it's who we were at the time. We made those specific decisions, which gave us those specific results. And that's where raising awareness comes into play, evolving, accepting responsibility. So a person who's complete within themselves would never blame it on the experimenter or on somebody else for anything that they were told to do, because we always have a choice. We always have free will, and we must respect that, which is the third part of the life leadership paragon, you know, respect for free will. If a participant says, I don't want to do this anymore, my heart's hurting, I want to stop, there is no other direction to go. You stop. It's done. Doesn't matter what anybody says, who they are. I don't care if it's God himself that says to continue. Uh-uh. That person has expressed a desire to stop. You must honor it. If you take your power back, by knowing who you are and why you are who you are, determining that, taking responsibility for yourself, and respecting others by not trying to control them or manipulate them, and respecting their choices, you will become complete within yourself, self-actualized,
you know,
and
we have a new
avoid those things.
Sorry, Doug. See, we're overlapping a little bit, and I think I have a delay in my sound somehow. There's a question in the chat: do you think codependent relationships are based on them esteem? And I have answered yes. So,
well, yes, it is, because think about it. If I'm codependent, I'm taking care of the world. The world's resting on my shoulders. Codependent people are strong people. They can do a lot. They can carry a lot. But it's still control. They're still trying to control things in their own way. And it helps them to feel special because look what I've done. I have been, you know, giving and giving and giving until I have no more to give, and then I give some more, and I can carry everything, and I can make sure it gets done. It's part of that disorder, really.
And he's also adding in here the possibly unhealthy abusive relationships as well, which lends to that, you know, the secondary
game. Yes, amen. You nailed it. If you are in an unhealthy relationship of any kind, whether it's an intimate relationship or a family relationship, a friendship, a business relationship, doesn't matter. If it's unhealthy or abusive or toxic in any way, what are the secondary gains? What do you gain if you remain in the relationship? Here's an example. One of the things I've dealt with many, many times over the last decade in alcoholic relationships where the abused person, which is usually the codependent person, abused by the alcoholic, and they have no marketable skills. Often a woman has no marketable skills because the abuser, the alcoholic, has basically kept them dumb. They've controlled them so much that these poor women don't have any marketable skills. So now they're stuck. How are they going to get along, them and their kids, if they leave the relationship? So the secondary gains become we survive. Part of the Stockholm Syndrome, actually. But we survive by staying in this relationship. If we leave it, we might die. So it really boils down to an unconscious question of survival.
You know, and there's also this lack of accountability to words and emotions. If there's a threat and you don't like it, you have to hold somebody accountable to that threat. Or if there's a statement, you know, and if you don't do this, then I'm going to do this, and you say, okay. You know, sometimes it's as simple as, you know, I would ask my kids, what do you feel like having for supper? And they'd all shrug their shoulders, so I didn't cook. You know, you're either going to participate in the process of life in a good way, a healthy way, or not. So there's got to be an accountability, I believe, to even the smallest things. But people don't like the abrasiveness of being unliked or challenged. And this is the shame of it, I'm afraid, that in order to, you know, in order to be yourself and stand up in who you are, you're going to encounter challenge. It's a given. But that's what it takes to spread that word as well.
Mm-hmm. So I hope that tonight's topic has been of value to you. It's a fascinating topic. And again, I will encourage you to look more up on it. Go to do an online search for Stanley Milgram, M-I-L-G-R-A-M, the Milgram Experiment. Go to YouTube. There's a bunch of videos on it. It's fascinating, and it's interesting, and it will help you to raise that level of awareness so that you're prepared if a similar, in principle, event may arise in your life.
You know, seeing the visual of the Milgram experiment really does lend to the emotion, rather than just hearing it, you know, as we're speaking about it and as you've described, which is really accurate, Doug, the visual is the emotional stimulation that you could feel when actually, you know, going in to watch some of those YouTube videos. I know it surely made a difference for me. The concepts of these, you know, are not foreign to me, having studied, you know, hypnosis back when I did, and, you know, states of mind, psychology, sociology. But this particular experiment, I don't know where it's been underground either. I love the internet for this.
Mm-hmm.
So many old studies that, you know, have been in this underground or put away in a box somewhere are finally surfacing, and they're fascinating. You know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just have to look at the wheels we already know about. So
yeah, I'm just amazed I missed it all these years, because there's been a number of repetitions of this experiment over the last five decades, really. You know, a lot of people have reproduced this, and it's been on news shows, it's been on documentaries. I just don't know how I missed it up till now, but man, I'm sure glad I came across it, because it explains so much.
Well, and as you said earlier, it easily makes us think, you know, about the little things in our everyday life that we do that gives our power to an authority. And it's a huge revelation on, again, many levels, from our, you know, very basic friend relationships, intimate relationships, you know, family relationships, on how we do give it away. I might just, you know, insert here again to reinforce to people, self-completeness and knowing who you are does not mean that you're contrary to the outside world. It only means to say that you know who you are, you're accepting of other people, and we negotiate a way to live more healthfully together, because that's our ultimate goal.
Yes, and you know, it also, this whole thing, everything we've been talking about tonight, coincides with the principles of MCHS Church in doing no harm, but not stop there, to actually do right. Everything else is founded on those two principles. And it also coincides with the teaching of be your own counselor, be your own guru, seek your own truth, follow your own path. You have a right to your perspective as much as anyone else, no more, no less, as much to any authority figure, no more, no less. Obviously, we're not saying, you know, disobey the laws of the land, but if those laws of the land change and tell you to kill somebody, you got to rethink it. But in general, everyday life, don't be afraid to be you, because it's fine. You deserve that without judgment. You can be you, and you have to take your power back in these ways.
You know, something that was just brought up in the chat real quick, you know, talking about what happens, you know, our brain patterns, thought patterns, and I've added in beliefs. And I think that's a really good topic that I'd like to address a little bit more of next week, belief systems and how we're ever changing people and changing our minds all the time and basically about who we are. So that'll be a good show next week too.
Yeah, and I'll be talking about adversity, what it is and how to deal with it. And a lot of people have adversity these days, you know, the economy and a lot of things, relationship problems, a lot of things like that. So I'll be telling you exactly what adversity is and how to overcome it. And this is just not stuff you're going to hear everywhere, so you want to tune in for that. And here's another thing I'd like to ask. If you like the topics we discuss in this program, please share it with those who might be open to it. You know, we honestly don't have that much of a listenership at this point. And the messages that we talk about on this show can really change lives. So, you know, I hope that you will keep it in mind with friends, with acquaintances, with anybody who might need some help in any of these areas of life skills. We appreciate everybody's time tonight. We thank those who tuned in live. We thank those who listened to the archive. Thanks to Reverend John Hightower for being there behind the scenes. Great show, Vicki.
Thank you, Doug.
And we'll look forward to seeing everybody next week. Have a great week. Thanks.
White lights, everybody.